loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Few individuals have had such a tremendous impact on history as former Cuban President Fidel Castro. He turned 90 on Saturday, despite literally hundreds of attempts on his life by the CIA and others. All over the world, certainly all over Latin America, people celebrated his milestone birthday, especially in Cuba, of course. On this special episode of Loud and Clear, we take a look at how Cuban society was fundamentally transformed under the leadership of this giant of contemporary history. We are joined by legendary actor and longtime activist in solidarity with the Cuban people, Danny Glover. We are joined by Gail Walker. She is the executive director of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizations. She's talking to us from New York. And by Gloria Lariva. She is the coordinator of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee, formerly the coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The three of you have been intimately connected to the Cuban Revolution and specifically in solidarity with Cuba's desire, its aspirations, its struggle to be a free country, to be an independent country, to be a self-determining country, to be a country that provides support for its own people and people all over Western Hemisphere and, in fact, all over the world. Danny Glover, talk about the historicality of Fidel Castro from your own point of view. You've been to Cuba. You've been involved in the support for the Cuban Five. Talk about it, if you would.
You know, I think about the periods when I was involved in African Liberation Support Committee in the early and mid-70s. And certainly the support committee supported the independence and the end of apartheid and the colonial relationship that Namibia had with South Africa and the liberation or independence of Portuguese colonies, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, and Angola. And I remember closely following the Portuguese dictatorship and an overthrow in 1974, which led to the immediate independence of these countries. And yet these countries, which had fought for more than for decades for their independence, their right to self-determination, these countries were under assault immediately by South Africa. And how the Cuban forces, the Cubans, without even notification to the Soviet Union, the Cubans provided immediate necessary military aid to those men and women. And that was one of the most important things that I remember about that experience.
So we have the Cuban volunteers, tens of thousands of whom went to Angola to fight against the racist South African government. Gail Walker, when Nelson Mandela became free, when he became the head of state, but I believe even before that, when he was free, the first head of state he visited was Fidel Castro. He said when Africa called, Cuba answered, just as Danny Glover was talking about. Talk about the internationalism that is a hallmark of Fidel Castro's leadership.
You know, it was really quite amazing to hear Nelson Mandela when he really just unabashedly really spoke about his love and respect and admiration for not only Cuba, but for Fidel Castro. And I recall when he was interviewed by ABC's journalist, whose name I'm blocking on right now, but who tried to sort of, you know, vilify Fidel, and how Nelson Mandela really just boldly embraced him and did not shy away from that. But you're absolutely right, and so is Danny. I think that Cuba's incredible commitment on the international stage is something that has been endeared Cuba to many nations around the world. And of course, that continues to still be the case. Africa certainly has benefited from wonderful relations with Cuba over the years. Stating back to, as you mentioned, Angola and the battle against apartheid. And of course, more recently, up to today and the fight against Ebola, when no other nation would sort of step forward and dare to send doctors to aid Africa. Cuba was there. That cry that when Africa called, Cuba answered, continues to this day. And not just in Africa. I mean, there's countless nations across the globe that have benefited from Cuba's internationalism in the form of doctors, in the form of medical care, in the form of soldiers when that was necessary, standing up, you know, through initiatives such as ALBA and CELIAC and UNASUR in various corners of the world. Cuba has continued to shine as an example. And of course, Fidel Castro has been that symbol, that incredible force that has really helped to bring forward that incredible legacy that not only he, but the Cuban people have really embodied. So it's a great, great, rich history.
That was the voice of Gail Walker from IFCO in New York City. We are also on the phone with Danny Glover, legendary actor, and with Gloria LaRiva. She was the national coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. They are free. And of course, there is the process of normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba. It hasn't been completed, many, many obstacles, but it certainly has started at the same time and coinciding with the release of the Cuban Five, who had been held for many, many years in U.S. prisons. Gloria LaRiva, I want to ask you about the outsized role of Fidel Castro and Cuba in the world political scene. I mean, we're in a planet that has 7 billion human beings. Many, many countries are much, much bigger than Cuba. Cuba's about 13 million people, probably. It's an island country. It had been dominated by the United States. And yet Fidel Castro's birthday, the 90th anniversary, it's commemorated everywhere. When you look at, if you did a Google search, Peru, Ecuador, Venezuela, all over Latin America, but indeed all over the world, people are celebrating it. And I want to ask you about the outsized role of Fidel Castro in the Cuban Revolution. Of course, we know the U.S. government tried to stop it. CIA Director Alan Dulles said in December 1958, days before the victory of the Cuban Revolution, we must prevent Castro's victory. Of course, they failed. They've done a lot to try to stop the revolution since then with the blockade and, you know, counter-revolutionary sabotage, etc. But talk about why Cuba has this outsized role for such a small country in world politics and why Fidel plays that same outsized role.
Well, I think beginning with the victory of the Cuban Revolution, it was a remarkable achievement given that it was only 90 miles away from the United States and was recognized as a colony and a neo-colony of the U.S. with total control. So with every move of the Cuban Revolution in the early days of the expropriation of the land within 5 months of the triumph, people were looking to see what was going to happen, and there was this complete boldness on behalf of Fidel and his leadership and the masses that there was no holding back on taking over all the U.S. property. So I think people were looking to see would they succeed. I think for the 5 decades until Fidel had to retire because of illness, there was constant predictions that Cuba could not last, and yet it did. I think largely because of his leadership and inspiration, but all along the way because he formed and helped create a mass of people who is the revolutionist, not just an individual, but he played the singular role in creating the Cuban Revolution. So I think it inspired people. When the Bay of Pigs invasion happened, you can see old documentary footage of protests all around the world that people were not going to let Cuba stand alone. And I think that is why when the special period happened, for example, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and again, the predictions that it could not last, that it would fall, it could not survive, you know, the loss of its greatest ally and trading partner, Cuba showed otherwise. And people were responding to that with solidarity that was a reflection of what Cuba had done for other people. So it's a great achievement and why he was celebrated on the 13th, but also the celebrations continue all this year.
Danny Glover, I want to ask you about the role of solidarity with in the interrelationship between progressive forces in the United States and Cuba and the Cuban Revolution. At the time of the Cuban Revolution, as I quoted, Alan Dulles said, we must do everything to prevent Castro's victory. But at that time, the Cuban Revolution elicited a lot of support, not just from radicals, not just from socialists, but even from liberal people. You had Frank Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe, like well-known personalities who were moved by and sympathetic with the Cuban Revolution. But then over time, as the war against that revolution by the CIA intensified, Cuba became so demonized in American media that a lot of the named support, the personalities, the well-known celebrities who supported Cuba, they were afraid to support Cuba. But you, as a very well-known film actor, very famous, you have been unabashed in your support for the Cuban Revolution, the right of the Cuban people to determine their own destiny. And you've been to Cuba and met with Fidel. So talk about your impressions.
Well, first of all, there tends to be, and this is not even to anything put down the immediacy of something happen and the of event happening and people rallying around the event. Not to put that down at all, but there tends to be a romanticism around the process of change in the sense. We see the event and we hear about the event and we hear all the events and we celebrate. Then you get to into the real kind of back and forth and other kind of deep political dynamics that happen around the event itself. I first heard about the Cuban Revolution just before my 13th birthday. And that was because my parents, who were postal employees, worked at the post office as a part of a union that began to emerge as a strong force. Forces in that union were African Americans in 1959. With the democratic change in the post office, racial democratic change in the post office, the first thing they were doing that I remember was celebrating the Cuban Revolution. For the 12-year-old kid, I wanted to know what was this about. You know, what were these people celebrating this particular country? And for me, that has been a task, something that I have embraced, just as I've embraced the movements around the world for virtually the majority of my life. What is this about? What is this dynamic? And certainly, we all get caught up in the romanticism of this. You know, the charismatic, the charisma of someone like Che Guevara, the charisma of someone like Fidel Castro, and all the other players in that, and that played a prominent role in what was happening. So there is this sense, and I believe in some sense, where people become so jaded by what they hear in the established press and the press, the normal press. And they're looking for some way, and not simply to disassociate from what their early ideas were, but they're looking for some way to justify their new beliefs or new ideas. I think that happens in everything else because we're distant from the process itself. And even when we're in the process, given our ideas and given the manufacturing of consent that happens, even when we're in the process, there is this kind of sense of not knowing whether we're believing the right thing, who to believe, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I gave a long just discussion about what I feel that people go through. Have I been disappointed in certain things that happened in this process? Of course. But you have to believe in the process itself. And those people who study socialism and purists and socialist ideals or ideas around communism been disappointed in the Cuban journey? Yes, that some have been in some way and written Cuba off in that sense. But there is a dynamic that's happening that I think continues to happen because the narrative and the course of this, what we call socialism, unwritten by anyone, unrealized by anyone, in a sense, is still happening. And what is this transformation? What is the transformation of who we are as human beings? What are the transformations in we're building solidarity? What does that transformation mean in all those manifestations in that sense? And some we may agree with, some we may disagree with, you know? And in some sense, to think about Cuba's service to bringing, as Gail mentioned, being the first to respond to the Ebola crisis in Africa, Cuba being the first to respond to the Pakistani earthquake, and sending female doctors and female understanding the cultural implications of healthcare and everything else in another country, in a Muslim country, that they were able to do this. All this thoughtfulness and thinking in terms of that. And certainly, what about the thinking about a world-class health system where the per capita expenditure is less than $800? What is the thinking behind that? What is the sense of entitlement? And when that entitlement in itself, yes, it forms people. It changes people. What about the new ideas as it translates into where it's going now, whatever that journey is, which is territory unknown?
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for the moment. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Fidel Castro turned 90 last Saturday, August 13th. People in Cuba, of course, celebrated this milestone birthday. So did people all over Latin America and, in fact, all over the world. We're talking about the outsized role of Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, a small country, but a country that's had a huge impact not only for its own people, but for Latin America, for Africa, for people elsewhere. We're talking with Danny Glover, legendary actor. We're also talking with Gail Walker. She's the head of IFCO, Pastors for Peace in New York City, and with Gloria Lariva. She was the national coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. Gail Walker, before we left for a break, Danny Glover was talking about Cuba not as a heaven on earth, not to be romanticized per se, but something that's a process, a revolutionary process, but a process filled, of course, with all of the contradictions that come from being human beings, but human beings in a colonial setting or a post-colonial setting, and also the problems that come with being under the gun of the most powerful economic and military power in the world, just 90 miles away. You go back and forth to Cuba, you bring supplies, you break the blockade, so to speak. That's what IFCO and Pastors for Peace and your father, who led that effort originally, your father, Lucius Walker, who's now passed away. When you went to Cuba for the first time, what was your reaction? I mean, obviously you knew a lot about Cuba from a distance, but as a person, as a woman, as a progressive person coming from New York City, what did you think? What did you feel?
You know, that was quite a journey. That was back in 1992, my very first visit to Cuba. And of course, later in that same year was the very first U.S.-Cuba friend shipment caravan that we led to Cuba, as you mentioned, under the leadership of my father, the late Reverend Lucius Walker. And we've been working to, you know, continue to push and break the blockade every year since. But that first visit, I think, you know, I was listening to Danny talking about the significance of his parents and the way that he was able to really learn and understand the revolutionary significance of Cuba. I too, who had progressive parents, and particularly my dad, really had an understanding and a deep appreciation for Cuba. But not until I was actually there in the country, talking to people, having the wonderful opportunity to meet Fidel Castro, who's it's hard to imagine now, is celebrating. We've just celebrated his 90th birthday. But what a tremendous example that he and Cuba have provided for the world. And I agree. Yes, Cuba is certainly not a utopia, and it's not even in the words of my father, who I remember during that first visit, when the caravan had broken the blockade, was referencing the work of the caravan and making a reference to the tradition of Moses, who he had, you know, indicated was somebody who had also spoken out and, you know, against the powers, to say no to the powers, to say no to Pharaoh. And it was he was making a reference to the caravan and the ways that as Pharaoh had said that Moses couldn't take his stuff with him when he crossed the Red Sea. The U.S. government was saying we couldn't take our stuff, Bibles and bicycles and medicine. And, you know, and referencing that, my dad was saying that, you know, Cuba's not necessarily the utopia or the promised land, but it certainly was that we were going in that direction as we were able to cross the border that very first time. And Fidel's response to that was actually really beautiful. He said that the caravan was really, in many ways, continuing to write the pages of the Bible, and really referred to the work of the caravan as something that was truly biblical. And I think that that sort of is a reflection of the man, of the various levels of complexity, you know, in terms of, you know, his incredible mind and thinking. And it was just really inspiring to be there, to talk to the people, to, as a woman, as a Black woman, as someone who was able to walk the streets and have conversation with regular everyday Cubans, is something that I will always cherish and remember. And that's why we continue to do the work that we do, to bring people to Cuba to see for themselves, to have that experience, because there's nothing like that kind of face-to-face interaction to help combat the years and, you know, levels of misinformation that is so prevalent in the world still today about Cuba. Much of that's changing, as you've already indicated, but I think that first visit for me really is helps to me, inspire me to continue to want to bring other people to Cuba to see it in all of its complexions and levels of complexity, but to help have a real appreciation for what it is that Cuba represents.
That was Gail Walker. She is the executive director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizations in New York, IFCO. Gail was in Cuba just a few weeks ago, along with one of our other guests, Gloria Lariva, for the July 26th commemoration. July 26th is the anniversary of when Fidel Castro and a small number, about 200 armed guerrillas, stormed the Moncada military barracks, a very bold attempt that failed militarily. Fidel was arrested, imprisoned. Most of the people who participated were killed. Some of them were killed after being tortured by the Batista government. Gloria Lariva, I want to talk about Fidel as a political leader, because he's quite remarkable in the sense that he actually led an armed struggle, a revolution. You had Mao Zedong in China, of course, when the Chinese Communist Party came to power in 1949. There have been some other instances, but there's not many people in history who lead a revolution, an armed struggle, succeed against all odds, and then go on to help create a new government and reorganize society. So that in itself gives Fidel Castro a fairly unique, or not completely unique, but almost unique role in modern history. Che Guevara wrote about the landing of the guerrillas after Fidel got out of prison, out of following the Moncada attack. He went to Mexico. He reorganized a small band of guerrilla fighters, and they went back to commence the armed struggle again in 1956. And 3 years later, miraculously, they took power. But Che wrote about being on the harrowing journey of the yacht Granma, the boat that they had bought to bring the guerrillas from Mexico to Cuba. He said, "The entire boat had a ridiculously tragic aspect. Men with anguish reflected in their faces, grabbing their stomachs, some with their heads inside buckets, others fallen in the strangest positions, motionless, their clothes filthy from vomit. I mean, how did such a ragtag group of rebels overthrow a dictatorship after just a few years?"
It is precisely because of Fidel's leadership, I think, in every episode, starting with the Moncada attack. And it's remarkable that with such a tragedy of almost all of them tortured and murdered, that they continued to follow him. And it's because of the conditions in Cuba that they were intolerable under the Batista regime. and also the courage that Fidel and his young men displayed. So when they came back, there's another episode when they came back and landed from the Granma boat, as you said, in such a terrible condition. Within a couple of days, they were bombed by the Batista regime. Most of them, again, were killed. And only about a dozen made it to the Sierra Maestra Mountains, where Fidel asked his brother, Raul, how many weapons do we have? And he counted seven. And he said, okay, we can start the revolution. He declared right away, Fidel said, we are in the Sierras. The days of the dictatorship are numbered. And a little over 2 years later, Batista had to flee. But I think it was because not only of Fidel's courage, but also that he was very perspicacious in understanding the conditions of the people who were ready, desperate for change, and were ready to fight for it. It's that combination of leadership and courage, but also an understanding of the people. So that I think that is the signal characteristic of Fidel.
Danny, go ahead.
Such an extraordinary moment in world history of revolt, and a great deal of revolt, even though most of the argument says that it was an East-West conflict. The conflict was around nationalism. Whether we find it in Africa, whether we find it in the Middle East, whether we find it in Central America and Latin America, around nationalism and self-determination were the predominant themes of that particular period. And the idea around nationalism brought together various forces, internal forces, supportive forces, forces that were able to capture the imagination of people, of citizens. Not ideology, but the sense that of self-determination and proclaiming their sense as a nation, claiming their autonomy and all those things in a period of these breakup post-World War II, these colonial powers. So it's a very extraordinary moment in human history. And you find so many extraordinary leaders that come out of that period. Certainly nonetheless, with the defeat of the French in Dien Bien Phu, Ho Chi Minh, and their great leadership here. So you have this world revolt that the former colonists were scrambling to try to figure out how to subvert, how to curtail, and everything else. The overthrow of Mossadegh and the elected nationalist, the president of Iran. You know, you can go on and on and on and on. The overthrow in the Dominican Republic, the overthrow in Guatemala, of nationalist government. So this is an extraordinary period in our history right now. Map of the world was being reformed in a different way. While the U.S. was the most dominant power and had been after the outcome of World War II, had now found itself fighting itself and fighting it on behalf of the other governments, past colonial powers. So it's a very incredible moment that certainly Fidel marches into in 1953, you know, with the attack.
Very interesting. Fidel said, Gal Walker, and I want to, it's just sort of along the theme of what Danny Glover is talking about. He said, men do not shape destiny. Destiny produces the man for the hour. In other words, he's explaining the role of the individual, including his own role, and that the destiny isn't just inside of Cuba. There is poverty in Cuba. There is unemployment in Cuba. There is national oppression. There is the desire to be free people. But it's part of a global current, as Danny was talking about. We had the Egyptian Revolution in 1952, the attempt to have an independent government in Iran that was overthrown by the CIA in 53, the Guatemala experiment under Arbenz that was again destroyed by the CIA in 1954, the Vietnamese rose up and defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu, the Iraq Revolution in 1958. I mean, when you look at that, with that whole period, what we saw in Cuba, again, destiny shaping the man, was we saw in Cuba that destiny was lifting all of those colonized and semi-colonized people into a state of revolt, and they were drawing energy from each other in their struggle against imperial domination. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, Cuba, as we've been stating, and Danny just really eloquently laid this out as well, is you can't take Cuba out of that historical, that really rich historical geopolitical context. That's, you know, without a doubt. And I think that the beauty of Cuba's revolution is that it continues to morph and change and be perfected over time. You know, we hear, and I've said it and others have said it, we're not trying to state that the Cuba is perfection, but it is, it's not a utopia, but there is this effort to really, I think, address not only the needs of the Cuban people, but the needs of all people who struggle for justice across the globe. And Cuba continues to be that wonderful example. I think, you know, I just want to just to step back and say, I think that the success of Cuba is also in many ways thanks to the Cuban people who respected and protected Fidel and his, as you mentioned, his ragtag army of men and women in the Sierra Maestra Mountains in eastern Cuba. But certainly, you know, at the core of Cuba's success was Fidel's bold leadership and his. He could have gone on to do many other things, but he embraced his people and the cause for justice, and so loved and revered, and that's why we saw such a tremendous outpouring of love and support, not only in Cuba on his birthday, but also, as you mentioned, across the globe, certainly here in the U.S. as well. But just one area of, you know, we could talk about so many areas in which Cuba has really shined, but in terms of, you know, addressing illiteracy and poverty, and but health, the way that Cuba has really exported doctors and its vision of healthcare that's rooted in really preventative care is a tremendous example. And you know, Brian, that there is this wonderful school, the Latin America School of Medicine, that Cuba has created, I mean, morphed from a military naval barracks into a medical school, and are training thousands and thousands of graduates from dozens of countries across the globe to become doctors, with the understanding that they'll return home and serve in underserved communities. And there are now more than 150 U.S. grads that have benefited from this tremendous program. And that's the kind, that was the vision, a vision of Fidel. And that was the kind of, that is the kind of man that he is, and the kind of legacy that he continues to leave for the world. Just a tremendous example.
That's Gail Walker. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about Fidel Castro. His 90th birthday happened on Saturday, August 13th. We're talking about the unique, distinctive role of Fidel Castro, and, of course, the Cuban Revolution, which he led to victory in 1959, and its role both in Latin America and in world politics. We're talking to legendary actor Danny Glover. We're talking to Gail Walker. She is the executive director of IFCO. And with Gloria Lariva, she is the chairperson or coordinator of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee and formerly the national coordinator to free the Cuban Five. Gloria, I want to turn to you because we've been talking about the historic achievement and why the Cuban Revolution took place, to root it in a world process, the process of national liberation and anti-colonial projects that were taking place on all continents outside of Europe, in fact, or the North America. But I want to talk about what Cuba has done in the last 25 years. The Cuban Revolution enjoyed the support of a socialist bloc. It had the support, military, economic, and political support from the USSR, from socialist bloc countries in Eastern Europe, of course, from China and from Vietnam. The support went both ways, but there was an international alliance, a camp, so to speak, in which a small island country could have trade and military and diplomatic relations. That disappeared almost overnight with the overthrow of the Soviet Union. Gloria, you and I went to Cuba in 1994 during what was called then the special period, when Cuba really tanked economically. There was suffering, there was hunger, all of the trade had dried up. The United States intensified the blockade at that time, thinking the Cuban Revolution could be overthrown. We delivered $5 million worth of medicine, insulin, in fact, from Pfizer and some other pharmaceuticals that had donated it to a third party, because Cuba was 1 month short of being completely without insulin for 46,000 diabetics on the island. They went through a very, very tough period, but now Cuba has somehow managed to survive. And even though it's adopted many mixed economy sort of reforms, nonetheless, the revolution is there. The revolution keeps going. Talk about the special period and what is Cuba doing today? We have a new, Fidel is no longer the head of state. His brother Raul Castro, the second most important leader in the historic revolution, is the head of state. This will be his last term of office. But talk about that if you would.
Yes, I think that what was so critical to the survival of the revolution during the special period, which was not special at all, it was so much difficulty and suffering in the 90s, as you described, is that in the 1989, Fidel Castro had a nationwide speech in which he predicted that it was possible the Soviet Union may not last. He said it was unthinkable phenomenon if that were to happen, but he said if fate were to decree that one day we would be among the last defenders of socialism in a world in which U.S. imperialism had realized Hitler's dream of world domination, he said then we would defend this bulwark to the last drop of our blood. And that's in fact what they did, through the means of finding new sources of income, through tourism, foreign investment, which helped start up much of their industry, for example, their great nickel mining industry. And they survived with the enormous sacrifice of the Cuban people. Today, it's a new epic with the freeing of the Cuban Five, finally, in December 2014, but also the starting up of a diplomatic relations, the first in 55 years, with embassies in Havana and Washington. However, I think that the tactics of the U.S. is only changing in order to complete their dream of ending the Cuban Revolution. And so there are new challenges for Cuba today. The economic crisis that began anew in 2008, the financial crisis that started in the U.S., has affected Cuba. And most people are not aware that the blockade, the economic, financial, and commercial blockade, continues today. It's still very severe. And we saw evidence of that on a trip that I just took in July in Cuba. And I think that's our biggest challenge in the movement in the U.S. is to let the people know we must fight for the lifting of the blockade.
Danny Glover, President Obama, when he announced the shift in U.S. policy, when he announced that the U.S. and Cuba had agreed to reopen embassies in their capital cities, after a 54-year closure of those embassies, he made the argument that the blockade and the old policy towards Cuba, quote, did not work, that the United States, not Cuba, had become isolated in Latin America, that Latin America was standing with Cuba, and that something else had to be tried. From your point of view, is the normalization or semi-normalization of relations by the U.S. government under President Obama with Cuba, is it, as Gloria said, is it, do you think, an effort to maybe find another way to accomplish the same objectives, which is to stop or stymie or eventually get rid of the Cuban Revolution? Or how do you view it?
Well, there's several things that happened along the way. Isn't it ironic that if you look around the region, if you look around the world, name a country that has not had an internal friction or internal struggle that led to violence and whatever. Name a country in the developing world that did not go through some sort of period. Cuba has been the most stable country in terms of, except for the embargo, in terms of maintaining a progression despite the embargo, despite all the limitations, progression in its own development, without that development being truncated by internal violence or external attacks or whatever, in the last 54 years. So, yes, in Cartagena, just a few years ago, three or four years ago, everybody in Latin America said, we're not coming to the table to talk anymore if Cuba's not at the table. The only two people who voted against it were Canada and the United States. Even Honduras, even Colombia, staunch U.S. allies. said that we're not coming to the table unless Cuba is at the table in this conversation. Boom. That has to be a change. Is the objective still regime change? Yes, it is. Is the objective still to overthrow the socialist experiment? Yes, it is. Without a doubt. The fact is that there are going to be new ways in which they're going to incorporate that. They're going to now open up a space where we now have a different relationship with them through business interaction, eventually, through other ways in which I think that perhaps the test of Cuban ethics and everything else, even though the corruption, as Raul Castro said, is a main issue in Cuba, there are going to be all those different ways which are going to be subtle attempts to undermine the socialist experiment. So yes, the U.S. plan is the same plan as it was with the embargo. It's the same plan that had been in force when Dulles said in 1958, we can't let them come to power. It is still an attempt to overthrow and to undermine and to compromise this revolution.
Yeah, Walker, certainly Raul Castro, like Fidel, like the other leaders in the Cuban Communist Party and the Cuban Revolution, they understand just what Danny Glover and Gloria said, which is the United States has changed its tactics, but it's perhaps has the same objective, which is to carry out regime change. They know that. The Cuban leadership knows that. They prefer, though, to have the blockade eased or lifted because the economic problems are real problems. In other words, if an island country can't trade with its most powerful nearby ally, the country that before the revolution was its main trade partner, if they have to have all the additional expenses of transporting materials from thousands of miles away, materials that are readily at hand if there was free trade, genuinely free trade, if they were able to acquire financing from Western banks that right now are still being fined for having broken the blockade. The Cubans know all this. Do you feel when you look at what we're obviously seeing as a transition, we went from Fidel Castro, whose birthday we just celebrated, the country and the world celebrated, to Raul Castro. But Raul said, you know what, this is going to be my last term. I think the Cubans have adopted a new two-term limit in terms of executive authority. Do you think the Cubans are entering this transition from a point of view of confidence?
I believe absolutely. I think that, you know, that Cuba has, as you just laid out, I mean, really has such a rich history. And it's not 1959. We're now 2016. Where there has been this fight. The part of Cuba and those of us who have been in solidarity with Cuba over these many, many years to fight to lift the blockade, to change the U.S. policy toward Cuba. As Gloria rightfully said, that is really the direction that I think we need to continue to put our efforts toward. Understanding, as Danny laid out, that regime change, overthrowing of socialism, that those are still very much efforts that the U.S. government is engaged in. They have been since before the triumph of the revolution, back when we were talking about Cuba as the ripened fruit that, you know, was just ripe for the picking. Despite the fact that President Obama has, you know, visited the country, the first sitting U.S. president to visit Cuba in nearly, was it 90 years, there are tremendous challenges that Cuba continues to be under. And I think it's an interesting time, but there are allies. There are allies, I think, in the region. You know, so if we're talking about the various entities of CELIAC, and we've got Venezuela and ALBA and UNASUR and CARICOM and, you know, various countries that have really come to Cuba's defense in the region, but also internationally. As we know, the United Nations votes every year to really to talk about the horrific blockade of Cuba as a relic of the past that needs to be done away with. So there are allies that Cuba has, and that certainly is something that has emboldened, I think, and strengthened Cuba and its leadership, and had significance for the Cuban people. And then, of course, organizations in the U.S., not just IFCO Pastures for Peace, the Venceremos Brigade, and many other organizations that over the years have like Gloria's work to and Danny's, to support the release of the Cuban Five and to stand in solidarity with that movement until, you know, they were returned home. All of that is, I think, something that, that provides the foundation of support for Cuba as it continues to engage in this new era. And, you know, it's, I'm strengthened and I'm heartened by the fact that I know that even as Cuba is, you know, navigating these commercial, you know, this commercial world, they're doing things like, you know, working to maintain the majority control over, you know, certain business interests. That all said, there are challenges, and I think that Cuba is trying to do what it can to address those internally as well as, you know, within the external reality in which it finds itself in the region, but also in the world. But I would say certainly operating from a place of strength based on that support and that rich history that we've already been talking about.
Gloria LaRiva, we only have about 4 minutes left, so I want to be able to have a brief answer from you and then get to the other guests as well. President Obama, as a condition for the opening of the embassies in both capital cities, Havana and Washington, traveled to Cuba. The Cubans allowed him to travel there, but they also allowed him to speak on Cuban national TV and give a direct message to the Cuban people. Sadly, there was no reciprocation where Raul Castro or the leaders of the Cuban people could speak on national TV to the American people, so it's somewhat one-sided. But obviously, the Obama administration wanted to make its pitch towards the Cuban people. He was suggesting in that speech that Cuba needs to change, that Cuba needs to be more democratic, that it needs blah, blah, blah. In other words, it was sort of lecturing the Cuban people. And there was a strong reaction from a lot of Cubans, I think, and also a letter that Fidel Castro wrote sort of in response. Fidel, of course, in retirement, but he's Fidel Castro. And he wrote a letter where he said, we almost fell off our chairs when we heard about the president of the United States saying it was time for a major change. But he was also taking issue with Obama. Talk about that. 3 minutes left.
Yes. And the point is, this claim for change, Cuba's always changing. I think that they made enormous changes in order to survive in a capitalist-dominated world in the 1990s, and they're intensifying those reforms. But it will always be under their own decision, which is what Fidel explained in the letter. I'd like to say that I think Fidel's example, Cuba's example, is more relevant than ever when you see the Black Lives Matter struggle here and a never-ending list of police murders of Black and Latino youth. I was just in Cuba with a group of people who'd never been there before, and they were stunned by police who are not armed, who walked among the people. And that's an example for us. You look at Puerto Rico, where they say that 50 women are being exposed to the Zika virus every day, pregnant women, with a complete lack of health care in Puerto Rico. In Cuba, the Zika virus is being successfully combated for now because of the health care. And I think we need to look at what a society that where the people are in power can achieve, even with a blockade, even underdeveloped. And that's what I think we need to take away from the example of Cuba.
Other lessons that Cuba can use. This is the decade of the African descendant. And Cuba's population is 60% African descendants. One of the important things is that remittances that have been a very important tool for Cuba's survival as well. Remittances that have gone to those populations who were in Florida and other places in the United States who were able to send amounts of money. So there's a level of inequality that's developed, fiscal inequality. Cuba has to also address the issue of race as well. Now, the revolution has said that so much has happened. And granted, it does create an amazing achievements within the economic and the social life of the Cuban people. But the issue of race is still a major issue. Just as it is an issue in my country, as Black mothers, just as it's an issue in Latin America, all over Latin America, we have to address that where there's over 200 million African descendants living in this region and everything. So we still have to come to terms with that issue as well. Cuba is right there, but Cuba can be at the leadership at the point because of his own experience because of that.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are completely out of time. We've been joined for the full hour by legendary actor and longtime activist in solidarity with Cuba and for peace and civil rights, Danny Glover. We've been also joined by Gail Walker, executive director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizations, and Gloria Lariva, coordinator of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.